This is Second Look. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director. Good Sunday afternoon. Stay tuned. In the next half hour, WMRA's Jesse Nadler takes us to a place that you may not have even heard exists in the Shenandoah Valley to expose conditions that are disturbing. The juvenile detention facility near Stanton that houses dozens of unaccompanied immigrant children who say they fled horrific conditions south of the border. A lawsuit alleges mistreatment and inhumane conditions there. Meanwhile, in response to the explosion of sexual harassment allegations in recent months, one Virginia congresswoman is pushing new training requirements for members of Congress and their staffers, even though experts disagree over whether such training actually works. And we get a review of the week in Virginia politics. But first, Charlottesville is undergoing an affordable housing crisis, so the nonprofit organization Impact, that's Interfaith Movement Promoting Action by Congregations Together, invited Dave Leibson, the vice president of Alliance for Housing Solutions in Arlington, to provide an Affordable Housing 101 crash course at the Church of the Incarnation in Charlottesville early last week. WMRA's Marguerite Gallerini reports.
The foundation's primary mission, says Executive Director Mindy Goodall, is to attract and retain officers in the community. One of the issues this solves is a quick, efficient response to emergencies.
Let's say that they need to call in the reinforcements, and, you know, if they have 45 minutes to drive to get to this area, that's a problem.
But it also helps officers and citizens bond.
We want officers to stay in our community because you get to know the people that you're serving. You start to put down roots. You understand the neighborhoods. You understand the different idiosyncrasies of an area.
That's why they try to help officers settle in the city.
We have a program, an officer housing program, where officers can apply for a $20,000 grant towards the down payment of a home inside the city of Charlottesville or 3 driving miles outside of the city.
Applicants should have a household income below 150% of Charlottesville's annual median income.
We try to fund about 2 to 3 of these per year. I don't think we've ever had to turn down a police officer.
But Goodall says the main obstacle remains that of available affordable housing to begin with. And so the Charlottesville Affordable Housing Fund will commit $2.5 million towards affordable housing in the city in 2018, the highest allocated amount since its inception in 2007. For WMRA News, I'm Marguerite Gallerini.
Affordable housing in Charlottesville also affects a very specific group, police officers. The Charlottesville Police Foundation is a local nonprofit organization that has been helping officers in the city since 2004. And the organization does that through a variety of programs, from extra training to partnerships through grants and various community events, as well as housing assistance. And for that story, Marguerite talked with the foundation's executive director.
Dave Leibson has been managing and supporting affordable housing in the U.S. and abroad for 40 years, so he knows why it matters.
If you're concerned about education, the success of our children very much wrapped up in the housing and the neighborhoods they live in.
About 40 people came to listen carefully to his talk. The goal? To provide the community with some tools to be effective advocates for affordable housing. He underlined the importance of partnerships and government help.
You're going to need help, whether you're trying to develop something or whether you're just advocating on policies. You can't do affordable housing without government help. The numbers just don't work.
He also underlined the importance of negotiations when planning new affordable housing projects.
Just to illustrate, for example, in Arlington, people who manage the budget don't want to do a bond for housing. But, well, what if they did a bond to do some of the infrastructure that's required for the housing? Suddenly I can take some of the cost off that project. The finance people don't have to say to the taxpayer, we're doing housing finance. Win-win.
And it's not just about the current crisis. It's also about the future.
20 years from now, you're going to be as dense as Arlington is. I know it. You should be planning and building your tools for that now.
For WMRA News, I'm Marguerite Gallerini.
A class action lawsuit filed by a 17-year-old Mexican boy detained at the Shenandoah Valley Juvenile Center near Stanton shines a light on what has been described as brutal, inhumane conditions faced by roughly 30 unaccompanied immigrant children confined there. Their crime? Entering the United States, often alone, to flee violence south of the border. WMRA's Jesse Nadler put together a two-part report, this first installment focusing on the conditions alleged by the lawsuit at SVJC.
His name in the lawsuit is John Doe. It alleges that from a young age, he was traumatized by gang violence in Mexico At 15, he fled the country but was picked up by ICE at the border. It says he was eventually transferred to the Shenandoah Valley Juvenile Center just outside of Stanton. It is one of two maximum security facilities that house unaccompanied alien children in the United States. The lawsuit accuses the center of failure to provide adequate mental health services for prisoners such as Doe, who are survivors of trauma. It alleges violence, psychological abuse, and excessive seclusion and restraint by an ill-equipped staff. Doe says he cuts himself and bangs his head against the floor to deal with feelings of desperation and helplessness. The center did not respond to requests for comment. The lawsuit echoes what other immigrant detainees have told Holly Webb, a third-year law student who works in the Immigrant Rights Clinic at Washington and Lee University.
They are running from terrible situations that most people can't imagine, like the kinds of violence and things that they've been through and seen. It would be comparable to a soldier coming back from a war.
Most of the kids come from El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. Webb and a fellow student helped one young Honduran apply for asylum. This child grew up in the violent city of San Pedro Sula and had been abandoned by his parents.
There was a neighborhood there that was actually called the Colony of the Dismembered.
The gang MS-13 descended on his neighborhood. People barricaded themselves inside their homes.
But the gang wanted this house that my client lived in, and they just took it over. I mean, they came up and showed up with guns and were like, we're taking your house. They tortured people on the porch. The kids, they saw it through cracks in the wall.
After years of tyranny, the child and his sister fled. Along with John Doe and 30 others, he's now housed at Shenandoah Valley Juvenile Center. It's one of a network of facilities contracted by the Office of Refugee Resettlement, the agency charged with the care and placement of undocumented children. The number of kids in federal care went from 6,600 in 2011 to more than 57,000 in 2014, according to a report from the U.S. Government Accountability Office. The surge caused ORR to scramble for beds, contracting with more detention facilities. David Baluarte is a law professor at WNL and a director of the Immigrant Rights Clinic.
And there is no state protection for these kids. So they come here in search of protection, and that oftentimes ends up being an asylum claim. Now, the asylum claims are very difficult to win. Legally, they're very challenging.
If unaccompanied kids can't be repatriated, either they say they're fleeing violence or they have no home to go back to, they may be released to family or another sponsor in the United States. Barring that, they stay in shelters, foster care, or detention centers. Those deemed dangerous go to Shenandoah. But some kids end up in these restrictive facilities unnecessarily. Some have been coached to embellish stories of their upbringing in order to bolster an asylum claim.
Some of the claims are pretty wild, about very young children claiming to have used weapons against multiple narcotraficantes who are conducting child sex slavery.
Seth Michelson is a poetry professor at Washington and Lee who works with these children.
So even if it were true, the child escaping sexual enslavement would be a traumatized survivor of sexual abuse and a refugee.
The irony is that these stories, embellished or not, can be used against them later. Webb again.
When they come into the facilities, they have clinicians and doctors, but nothing that they say is confidential. So whatever they report to their doctor also reports it to ICE. They're kids, and they tell them that they can trust them and tell me all about your situation. And then they go and file a report, and that's how they get kicked up in security levels.
Baluarte again.
You need to look in the face of these children and understand what they've been through. What this lawsuit has brought to light is not just that we're detaining these kids in such desperate need of help, but that we're detaining them in deplorable conditions. The circumstances in which they're being detained really aggravates some of the deep psychological trauma that they've suffered and that they need better care and treatment.
Webb's client never made it out of confinement. He was transferred to an adult prison upon his 18th birthday.
In part two of our report, Jesse takes a look at how these undocumented youth cope with confinement and trauma.
Once a week, Washington and Lee poetry professor Seth Michelson travels to the Shenandoah Valley Juvenile Center just outside of Stanton.
How can I help you?
Seth Michelson here for poetry.
All right, go on in.
Thank you.
He teaches poetry to unaccompanied alien children detained there.
Buen día, chicos. ¿Cómo estamos?
Bien, bien, bien. Buen día.
The minors range in age from 13 to 17 and hail mostly from Central America. They're locked up for crossing the United States border illegally, seeking to escape violence back home. Shenandoah Valley Detention is one of two maximum security juvenile facilities in the country. The kids are locked up there because of the danger they purportedly pose to themselves or others. Their migration stories are often horrifying. Violence, abandonment, sexual enslavement. Michelson uses poetry to help the kids work through past trauma. Reporters aren't allowed into the facility, so these recordings were made by Michelson.
I forget. Without reason to exist, I often forget that I am real, and this makes the soul I don't have ache, as if I'm walking somewhere, unable to find myself.
Some of the kids were conscripted into gangs and drug cartels before fleeing for the United States. A mural at the center features paintings by the children.
One child's work with the cartel was to dissolve dismembered body parts in vats of acid. That's what he painted as representational of his past. I mean, this is a child who's been through severe trauma.
But the immigrant children at this facility are not receiving adequate care and attention. This, according to a class action lawsuit filed in October by a teenage detainee from Mexico. It alleges beatings and psychological abuse by guards. Children are locked in their rooms for 12 to 14 hours a day. Nutrition is substandard. Meals are often served cold. Some of the kids don't even know why they're there.
Marriage. Yesterday in my cell, my pal asked, "Man, don't you want to marry life forever?" And I answered, "Why marry life if I can't divorce death?"
The brutal conditions of their confinement may end up re-traumatizing the children, according to the lawsuit. Michelson uses the weekly workshops to try to inject a little beauty and hope into their lives.
Poetry gives them a language to think about what they've been through, why they came here, what they hope to achieve and become. How they've suffered, how do you cope with a lonely night?
The workshops serve as a form of therapy.
Somebody reads something beautiful and everybody bursts into applause, and it's really special in that way.
The alternative coping method that is so prevalent among this population is disturbing and deadly. Aaron Ferber is a former student of Michelson's who has attended some of the workshops.
One week, I asked one of the kids, like, "Oh, where are your glasses at?" And he's like, "Oh, they were taken away from me because I was hurting myself with them." It's heartbreaking. I don't think there's another word to describe that.
Self-harm and suicide attempts are widespread. The lawsuit alleges indifference by guards. Michelson says he worked with one child who attempted suicide 6 times. I asked if he ever worries about giving these children false hope.
If it's false hope to keep them from committing suicide, then I'm glad that it's a functional false hope at least. Every one of these kids in different conditions would thrive. They'd do great in the local high schools. They'd be on the local soccer teams and the local dance teams. They would be dating and working.
A collection of their poetry has been published in a new book called Dreaming America. Most of the kids have never before owned a book.
So their first book that they possess is a book that they helped to write.
He hopes it gives them a will to live despite a very uncertain future. Proceeds from sales go to a legal defense fund on their behalf.
Thank you very much.
For WMRA News, I'm Jesse Nadler.
You can learn much more about this story at WMRA.org. As the wave of sexual assault allegations continues to break, one Virginia congresswoman is moving forward with a new training requirement for members of Congress and their staffers. But as Virginia Public Radio's Michael Pope reports, there's disagreement whether that training alone can be effective.
The House Administration Committee is not usually known for moments of high drama, but that's exactly what happened during a recent meeting when Republican Congresswoman Barbara Comstock recounted a story she had heard about an unnamed colleague. The male congressman asked a female staffer to bring over some materials to his residence.
The young staffer, as a young woman, went there and was greeted with a member in a towel. It was a male, who then invited her in. At that point, he decided to expose himself. She left, and then she quit her job.
A few days later, Comstock introduced a resolution requiring all members of Congress and their staffers complete mandatory sexual harassment training during each session of Congress. The resolution sailed through the House as a wave of allegations continues to add new names every day. But critics say there's a problem.
We know that mandatory training doesn't seem to work, or at least there's no evidence it does. And yet people keep deferring to that as a cure-all for the problem that ails us.
That's Susan Bissom Rapp, a law professor at Thomas Jefferson School of Law in San Diego. For more than 15 years, she's been a critic of the billion-dollar industry that's popped up around sexual harassment training. She says there is no empirical evidence this training changes behavior. In fact, she points to a university that studied its own sexual harassment training.
In fact, the training policy did not work, and it made men who went through the training less likely to be able to discern sexual harassment. It had no effect on the women.
Rather than requiring more training, she says, lawmakers should be focused on collecting data. That way, members of the public would know which members of Congress were using tax dollars to settle claims.
A settlement is paid out. You sign, if you're a victim, a non-disclosure agreement. And that prevents collection of data in the aggregate. So you can see if certain people are perpetrating harassment against others.
Not so fast, say leaders of the training industry. Ingrid Fredin is with Navex Global.
People are taking evidence of, hey, claims are still out there. There are still problems, as evidence that harassment training isn't working. And I don't think that that's the right way to look at this.
She says training is one element of tackling the larger cultural problem, an important element that should not be overlooked.
It's really interesting. People are trying to draw those conclusions, but they don't have support for the conclusion. We're not seeing studies where people are saying the culture is awesome, the training isn't effective.
Andrew Rawson is chief learning officer at Treliant, which also provides training. He says that many of the early sexual harassment training courses were poorly designed.
The main reason was not necessarily to prevent sexual harassment from taking place. It was mainly to provide a good defense when sexual harassment did take place.
He says a better way to approach the training is small and ongoing messages rather than huge chunks of time every 2 years.
A steady drip campaign of positive messages and ones that reinforce that the organization has got your back and has got a zero-tolerance policy, we think has a much better chance than the traditional, let me teach you what the law is, because that obviously doesn't work.
Comstock says one potential reason why no evidence exists to show training works is that the training itself is too generic. She says one way to handle that on Capitol Hill might be to create specialized training for congressional staffers, many of whom are in their first job out of college and might not realize when their bosses are behaving inappropriately. I'm Michael Pope.
Finally, let's check in with Jeff Shapiro, political columnist with the Richmond Times-Dispatch, for a review of the week in Virginia politics. Here he is talking with Soraya Wintersmith at our partner station in Richmond, WCVE.
This week, Governor-elect Ralph Northam added a few more pieces to the still-forming cabinet puzzle.
Three cabinet picks, one for transportation, former delegate Shannon Valentine of Lynchburg. She's a member of the Commonwealth Transportation Board. Matt Strickler, who was a former aide to Northam from his days as a state senator, has been selected for Natural Resources Secretary, and Bettina Ring. She is the state forester. She is the governor-elect's pick for agriculture and forestry secretary.
Northam and members of his administration will have to work with the Virginia legislature. And Jeff, we've been talking for the last couple of weeks about how control of the lower chamber, the House of Delegates, is down to a handful of districts with very tight victory margins. In four of those very tight races, recounts have been triggered, and at least one of those recounts is now behind us.
The just-completed recount was in Northern Virginia. Republican incumbent Tim Hugo was reaffirmed as the winner. According to this recount, he is prevailing over Dante Ponner by 99 votes. On election night, Hugo came out with a majority of 106 votes. Democrats are awaiting recounts for two other seats, one in Newport News, where only 10 votes separate the Republican incumbent and his Democratic opponent. That's the one that Democrats feel they can flip, and that would certainly have implications for control of the House. The other seat that is contested by the Democrats, if you will, going into extra innings, is one in the Fredericksburg area. It is the seat of the retiring Speaker, Bill Howell. That election apparently was won by a Republican by about 80 votes. However, the dispute over that seat centers largely on whether voters received and used the correct ballots. There's even a push by Democrats in federal court to have a new election ordered. The Republicans are pressing for one recount here in the Richmond area. Don Adams, a Democratic challenger, defeated Manoli Lapasi, Republican incumbent, also quite senior in the courts committee, and had a direct hand in the selection of judges across the state. Lucassi has already conceded. He lost that election by about 325 votes out of over 40,000 cast, and reversing that result might seem a stretch. But the Republicans, who went into this election with a 2-1 majority over Democrats, now are ahead by only 2 and fear that these recounts could make for a 50-50 House or even a Democrat-controlled House.
For politicos, when one election is over, attention shifts to the next. In 2018, there will be an election for the Virginia U.S. Senate seat currently occupied by Democrat Tim Kaine. And Virginia Republicans now have a few options in terms of the best candidate to run the challenge for that seat.
Tim Kaine, of course, the vice presidential nominee last year, heavily favored for a second term in the United States Senate. There are announced candidates. Two of them are rather provocative political personalities. Corey Stewart, the Trump sound-alike who nearly defeated Ed Gillespie for the Republican nomination for governor, and E.W. Jackson, the broadcast preacher who was pummeled by Ralph Northam in the 2013 lieutenant governor's election. Both Jackson and Stewart are big Trump fans, and unlike a lot of Republicans, they say there's more to be gained sticking with the president than straying from him. Another candidate is a member of the House of Delegates, Nick Freitas. He's from the Culpeper area, somewhat libertarian in his outlook, not especially well known. But it is clear as we head into the Republican Senate primary cycle that Stewart and Jackson will be magnets, powerful magnets for press attention. And with their appetites for the seemingly outrageous, capable of turning the Republican primary campaign into something of a sideshow.
Jeff Shapiro, our time is up. Always a pleasure speaking with you.
Good weekend to you, Soraya.
Support for WMRA's News and Information Fund, which makes our award-winning coverage possible, is provided by Bibb and Dolly Frazier, Les and Johnny Grady, Klein May Realty, Eugene Stoltzfus Architects, Joy Loving, Jenna Tretner, Nancy Barber, Pam and Jim Huggins, an anonymous donor, and by a grant from a donor-advised fund of the Community Foundation of Harrisonburg in Rockingham County. If you'd like to support our news coverage, go to WMRA.org, mouse over news, then click on News and Information Fund. And here's a great way to keep up with local and statewide news each day with WMRA. Subscribe to our daily news podcast. It's called the WMRA Daily. Just look for the WMRA black coffee mug with a yellow sticky note that says daily at WMRA.org. I'm Bob Levicki, WMRA's news director and Morning Edition host. I'll talk to you in the morning. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday.